Good morning and welcome to Occupy the Airwaves. Okay, today I decided to play two segments from Mark Sobota being interviewed on the radio show Critical Hour with Dr. Leone and Garland Nixon. I just love Garland Nixon. When he talks about the attack by Israel on the Iranian embassy, the involvement of ISIS and Ukraine as a team together again, drug running in Europe, and many other things. All right, with no further ado.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Critical Hour. We're coming to you from the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. I'm joined here by my co-host, political analyst, Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
For the next 2 hours, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. International reports, Ukraine turned into Afghan drug lords' paradise under Western watch. Over the past decade, Ukraine has played the role of a drug trafficking hub with illicit substances flowing to and from many regions, including Afghanistan. For insight into this, let's turn to our first guest. He's a Moscow-based international relations and security analyst, Mark Sloboda. As always, Mark, welcome back.
Dr. Leon Garland, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on the Critical Hour.
So it's reported in 2019 and 2020, British, Polish, and Ukrainian investigative journalists revealed that ISIS jihadists originating in particular from post-Soviet space used Ukraine as a transit point to and out of the Middle East in the course of the civil war in Syria, which started in 2011. And Mark, your thoughts on the veracity of this reporting, the validity of this story, because we know even before the United States went into Afghanistan, there were discussions that if the U.S. did that, that heroin production would increase dramatically, the price of heroin would drop dramatically because the market would be flooded with it. And there were also stories that one of Hamid Karzai's brothers was a drug kingpin in Afghanistan. That's just one example of there seems to be a pattern here. Is this part of that pattern?
Yeah, there is an absolute connection. One, on one hand, you have the West-backed Kiev regime in Ukraine, long using jihadist fighters, many of them former ISIS and Al-Qaeda from Syria, from Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And this has been reported on, acknowledged in the Western press, in the Sheikh Mansour Battalion, a particular battalion of Islamic jihadists, and also a separate grouping within the International Legion. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. You can take the Western media. Back in 2015, the Daily Beast, a very Russophobic rag, by the way, Chechen jihadis leave Syria, join the fight in Ukraine. The article details how they are former ISIS members. The Jerusalem Post: why is an ex-Syria war jihadist, in this particular case, Jabhat al-Nusra, which even the U.S. government acknowledged was just al-Qaeda rebranded, fighting for Ukraine against Russia? And then The Independent, the British newspaper, ran an article, how Ukraine became the unlikely home for ISIS leaders escaping the caliphate. That basically they found safe refuge and a transit point in Ukraine through which they could travel to Europe and the rest of the world. And at the same time, Western journalists have talked about how the numerous reports, as mentioned in this article, about Ukraine turned into an Afghan drug lord's paradise, about the drug trade flourishing from Ukraine. And there's a reason for this. And that is because of the specter in the room in the face of the Crocus City Hall attacks, ISIS-K or ISIS Khorasan. Now, ISIS-K came about as a result of a split in the Taliban during the fighting of the U.S. occupation of that country. And ISIS-K, for whatever reasons, they split off from the Taliban and then became to fight them. They turned to the opium trade to finance their fight against the Taliban. And when they lost the country, a lot of them joined the fight in Ukraine. And this included a lot of the former military, security services, and drug lords who used to be part of the U.S. installed government in Afghanistan until the U.S. withdrawal. They joined. So they took their drug trade and their jihad with them and decamped to Ukraine. Now, there's a problem here. The Taliban has long been against the heroin trade. During the U.S. occupation, for instance, in 2021, the last year of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, the World Bank estimated, the IMF World Bank estimated that the heroin trade itself was 14% of Afghanistan's GDP, which tells you about the bloom on the U.S. 14% of all economic activity in the country was the heroin trade. Now, since then, the Taliban has really suppressed, since recovering the country, according to Time magazine, they've suppressed the opium poppy cultivation in the country by 90%. Right. This means that the illegal trade to cultivate it gets more profitable. It gets more violent. And that becomes associated with the drug trade through Ukraine, what ISIS-K is able to still get out of Afghanistan and the neighboring countries. Now, this opium shortage, heroin shortage, is a huge problem for the West. Vice News, the Taliban's opium ban has become an existential problem for the West. And this is backed up by a UN government report. A worldwide shortage of heroin because of the Taliban, those evil people, has resulted in a boom in the United States and elsewhere of people turning to opioid replacements, including, you guessed it, fentanyl, which results in a lot of overdoses and deaths. So the West, through keeping Afghanistan as a narco state under their proxy government, was essentially feeding their own heroin addicted population with cheap, affordable, relatively safe heroin, keeping them nice and addicted out of any better way to solve the problem, I guess. And now they're worried that the Taliban has restricted the flow of heroin into the West. And I would imagine that what trade is transpiring through former jihadis of ISIS now in Ukraine for the regime is a bit of a lifeline, keeping some heroin flowing into Europe and then on to the United States.
Mark, if you could fill us in on the big story with the investigators finding evidence of Ukrainian trail in recent terror attacks, and of course, a request, or maybe one could say demand, made by Moscow to turn over certain suspects in Ukraine.
Okay, so the investigative committee into the Crocus City Hall continues its business in Russia. They've made several additional arrests. They appear to be rolling up a terrorist network. They've also contacted the Turkish government, which has detained a significant dozens of people that may have been involved in a training camp outside Istanbul, from some reports we've gotten. The links with the Kiev regime in Ukraine continue to slowly unfurl. So far, from the beginning, it's been exposed that the terrorists had plans and instructions to try to escape into Ukraine across the border, that a window would be open for them on the border to allow them to get through the conflict zone, which normally probably wouldn't be a good idea, an avenue to try to escape through. We also know now that the money connection that these quote-unquote terrorists really kind of mercenary terrorists were paid for was with cryptocurrencies, cryptocurrency transfers that originated in Ukraine, according to the investigative committee so far, from Ukrainian nationalists. Quite sure the particulars of that yet. They haven't put out further details. We also know that the voicemail instructions that were transmitted to the terrorists also came out of Ukrainian territory. Meanwhile, the Russian government, the Russian foreign ministry, has, through diplomatic protocols, contacted the Kiev regime in Ukraine with demands under the UN-adopted International Convention for the Suppression of Terrorist Bombings and the International Convention for the Suppression of the Financing of Terrorism, demanding the immediate arrest and extradition of the Kiev regime's head of their domestic spy agency, the SBU, Vasily Malyuk, and a number of other people that have not been publicly listed under him in the Ukrainian intelligence. Now, this may be connected to the Krokus City Hall attacks, but not necessarily. So after the Krokus City Hall attacks, within a few days, Russia launched missile attacks, actually using their brand new Zircon hypersonic missile, their most advanced, and they hit Kiev regime intelligence facilities of the SBU in Kiev. And we know that because the Kiev Post told us so. Now, the head of the SBU, this aforementioned Vasily Malyuk, he wasn't hit in the attacks, and he immediately went on Ukrainian TV. And he angrily did an interview where he admitted to the whole host of previous terror attacks that have been carried out in Russia over the last 2 years. He did this in a bit of an oblique way. He says, "We will not officially admit this in any way, but you've got the right address, and I will tell you all the details," which he then went on to do, including the specific 400 grams of thoroughbar that was used in the explosive-filled statuette that detonated in a crowded St. Petersburg cafe while targeting the former East Ukrainian war correspondent, Vladimir Tatarsky. The explosive used in the assassination of the Russian journalist, philosopher, Daria Dugina. The 800 grams of plastid that were used in a terrorist bombing attempt on the life of the prosecutor general of Lugansk, Sergei Gorecko. How the former Ukrainian Rada deputy, a dissident, was killed in Russia using a 9x19 caliber pistol. How the unwilling suicide attack on the Crimean Bridge by the SBU occurred. They used homemade explosive, a hexagon mixture that was disguised as rolls of greenhouse film that weighed 14 tons. And according to Malyuk, quote, "After this operation, the top leaders of Western intelligence agent services said, 'You are the best, Vasily. We take our hats off to you.' That was amazing." I mean, so he admitted to everything, every terrorist attack up to the Krokus City Hall attacks. So right after that, Russia went and filed this diplomatic protocol demanding his and his people's extradition to face crimes of state terrorism. And of course, the Kiev regime is not going to hand him over. But the point is two. One, as part of the ongoing information war, to make clear to the rest of the world outside the West that will actually report this, that the Kiev regime is a terrorist regime using terrorist tactics, right? Not conventional warfare, but, you know, deliberately targeting civilians in acts of political terrorism. And secondly, this is pre-litigation. This is the necessary first step before the Russian state files charges of state terrorism against the Kiev regime in international courts that will lie outside the control of the West.
Mark Sloboda, as always, thank you so much for your time. Greatly, greatly appreciate that analysis, and we look forward to having you back.
Thanks for having me.
We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Wilmer Leon, joined here by my co-host, Garland Nixon.
Thank you, Wilmer.
Russia strongly condemns Israeli attack on Iranian consulate in Syria. Quote, we consider any attacks on diplomatic and consular facilities, the inviolability of which is guaranteed by the relevant Vienna conventions, to be categorically unacceptable, according to the ministry. For insight into this, let's turn to our next guest. He's a Moscow-based international relations and security analyst, Mark Sloboda. As always, Mark, welcome back.
Dr. Leon Garland, thanks for having me.
So Garland and I have talked to a couple of other guests in the show about this attack, and primarily from the Iranian perspective. But the Russian foreign ministry said yesterday that they strongly condemn the attack and that they denounced the action as unacceptable. Mark, it just seems as though the United States and its allies, they're seemingly trying to do everything humanly possible to start a conflict somewhere, anywhere in the world. Mark Sloboda.
Yeah, Russia, they've gone more than just condemning this. So, because first of all, this attack was an egregious violation of international law, norms, and rights on several levels. One, of course, it was an attack on the sovereign state of Syria. I know it's become accepted largely in the West that they've decided that Syria has no sovereignty, that the U.S. illegal military occupation is still sitting in the east of the country, the Turkish occupation is still sitting in the north of the country, and Israel and the U.S. both make airstrikes into Syria whenever they feel like it, with absolutely no repercussions. And this has really hardly even drawn the attention of the Western press, because it's just accepted that Israel is allowed to conduct. And second of all, they hit a consulate, a diplomatic facility that is protected by the Vienna Conventions. This is one of the most egregious violations of international relations. I mean, even more egregious, I would say, than when the U.S. bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the NATO attack and invasion of Serbia, where they basically expressed their regrets but never even bothered to say they were sorry. And third of all, of course, that this was several Iranian, two top generals and seven total IRGC officials. I mean, this is like knocking off one of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This is what it is. Reza Zahedi, the general Reza Zahedi, he was in charge of the Quds force, you know, the most elite Iranian military force operations in Syria and Lebanon. So it's quite obvious that this was done as a provocation, and it's one of a long series of provocations. Israel is doing everything possible to provoke Iran into making an attack on them that would force the U.S. into a direct conflict with Iran. That is the goal of this. The end goal, the target, is actually the United States. Iran is really just a means of getting there. We have previously seen a plethora of Israeli airstrikes in Syria targeting Iranian officials because, you know, as we hear the U.S. say, every country in the world is allowed to, you know, have relations and ally with who they want to, except obviously for like Syria and Iran and everyone the U.S. is opposed to, I guess. They don't have the same rights. Syria can't ally, can't have Iranian officials on its territory without them being targeted. There was, in recent months, there was a bombing, a terrorist bombing of the anniversary of the funeral of the previous Quds Force commander, Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the United States in a drone strike in Baghdad in 2020. This does have echoes of that as well. There was a terrorist attack killing dozens of people on a memorial, really, of his funeral. That was almost certainly, I don't think anyone questions that that was organized by agents working for Israel. And there have been terrorist bombings of Iran's gas pipelines as well. All of these, Israel must be extremely frustrated that Iran has not taken the bait, that they have not overreacted in any way. In fact, they've hardly reacted at all to these actions, because Iran is doing their absolute best to avoid direct conflict with the United States right now. They've had Kataib Hezbollah stand down. I believe that they are most likely coordinating with Hezbollah to limit Hezbollah's operations. They've given every signal that they will seek, really accept an egregious amount of provocations and punishment by Israel in order to avoid a direct conflict with the United States right now. And this is Netanyahu's problem, because he is trying to escalate his way out of his failure to completely eliminate Hamas, which is essentially impossible without the complete ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people out of the Gaza Strip, which they want to do, but they have been frustrated to do by Egypt's refusal to open up the border for that purpose, knowing very well that the Palestinian people would never be allowed back in. So Netanyahu's only option is to escalate out, because there are completely different standards for winning here. Israel, because of the power imbalance and the declared intent, Israel has to completely eliminate Hamas, wipe them out completely. Hamas just has to survive, and they win, right? I mean, that's the imbalance of power. And Russia has gone further than condemning this attack as an obvious violation of international law, an act of aggression. The Russian head of the foreign intelligence, Sergei Naryshkin, he's gone further. He says that this is an ugly and criminal step by Israel. And he has said it is a terrorist act, that this was a terrorist act against both Syria and against Iran, which I think is probably the strongest criticism we have ever heard Russia make of Israel. At this point, I don't think we've ever heard anything. And Russia is obviously extremely concerned, because they have military forces in Syria. They have military forces in Damascus. And I don't think it's a surprise that just in the last 24 hours, Russia has opened another joint Russian-Syrian observation post in Syria, just outside the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights.
And I'll add this. Isn't it interesting that the U.S. has these angry twins in Ukraine and Israel? Both of them have gotten themselves into a mess that they can't get out of. And both of them see dragging the United States in as the only way to survive. But here's an important story we got.
Triplets, Taiwan.
Taiwan's. They're waiting to be smashed to bits. Taz reports, Biden shares with Xi Jinping his concerns about China's support for Russia. Oh, boy, I'm sure China's like, oh, well, good old friend Joe Biden, we know you're looking out for our best interest. I have a funny feeling that this concern of old genocide Joe ain't going to go real far with the leadership of the Chinese government. Mark.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Joe Biden had to, voice this as part of, any public account of a diplomatic discussion with China. But I'm quite sure China, Xi Jinping, did what China always does when the U.S. says that. They say that, they have a no limits partnership with Russia. It's their strongest bilateral relationship, and that their relationship with Russia is part of their own sovereign foreign policy and is not the business of the United States or anyone else. They are not participating in the U.S. existential economic war of sanctions on Russia. In fact, they have condemned it as a violation of international law. And, they're not at all interested. The accusations that the U.S. made that China is somehow helping Russia rebuild its military industrial base is just absolutely bizarre, because really Russia doesn't need China's help. Its military industrial base is outproducing NATO, the entirety of NATO's artillery shell production, altogether by 7 times. They don't actually need China's help. And then when you read into it, actually what they're talking about there is just the fact that China continues to trade with Russia and doesn't obey U.S. sanctions. That's somehow equated as helping Russia rebuild its military industrial capacity. Like, it doesn't already have greater military industrial capacity, at least for this type of conflict, than the United States itself does. It's just absolutely bizarre statements in the U.S. readout of this discussion.
Didn't we see a story last week that Russia has just decided to increase its production by 150%? Did you see that?
I mean, a whole host. I mean, Sergei Shoigu was making the rounds of another few military industrial facilities, you know, part of which was made public. And it is quite obvious that Russia's military industrial production is increasing, that it has not peaked, right? As some Western media, whom, you know, has come very belatedly to the fact that Russia is outproducing all of NATO put together. Now, they're like, well, yeah, but we're increasing and Russia has peaked. No, they haven't. It's quite clear from Sergei Shoigu's visits and the statements he's made in the readouts that a number of these Russian military industrial facilities are still expanding production. They're building new factory facilities. They're hiring more workers. And it's something very hard for the United States to take. They, you know, have for years fed themselves on this expert level Russia analysis that tells them that the Russia is Nigeria with snow and an insult apparently to both countries or a gas station, and to find itself outproduced by Russia while Russia maintains its civilian economy completely effectively untouched at the same time is absolutely blowing the minds of these U.S. officials in the Biden administration and larger within the deep state. It is challenging their sense of their own exceptionalism, their belief in their systemic and moral superiority to be unable to compete. How can we possibly be outproduced by Russia? We've got a larger economy. We've got more people, blah, blah, blah. But your military industrial complex wasn't geared up for this. It's a for-profit industry that promised it could build on demand without any surge capacity, and it can't. So suck it up.
2 points. One, I seem to recall early in the conflict that some of the analysis was President Putin was reluctant to go in heavy in terms of full-scale conflict because he understood the economic impact it would have on the Russian economy, and he did not want to put the stress on his economy that a full-fledged war would do. That's 1 point. And then understanding how the United States is traversing the world trying to instigate conflict, does this increase in production indicate to you that Russia is concerned that they could be involved or drawn into other conflicts further down the road? We've got just about 2 minutes.
Yeah. So first of all, I agree. Absolutely. Russia went into the Ukrainian conflict. They intervened in this ongoing civil conflict in 2022 with a very light force, only 150,000 troops, smaller than the Ukrainian military. But I believe that this was diplomatic. Right. Okay. They hoped to force Ukraine and the U.S. to a diplomatic settlement, you know, meeting Russia's demands that, among other things, the people of Donbas be protected and that Ukraine not join NATO. I don't believe that economic concerns were the primary. I mean, obviously, Russia feared that it would be affected by sanctions. But regardless, its belief that its limited show of force would communicate to NATO its limited intentions was naive and was just greeted as a sign of weakness by NATO. So I would say more diplomatic than economic. And secondly, with regards to Russia's larger economic production, I mean, there's no sign that it's slowing down or that it has affected the civilian economy way. This is a major U.S. policy failure with these sanctions.
Mark Sloboda, as always, thank you so much for your time. Greatly appreciate that analysis.
All right, that's the end of Occupy the Airwaves. See you next week.